Welcome to UEG Podcast, where we talk about scientific discoveries, educational insights, and professional development within the world of digestive health. Whether you're a clinician, researcher, or just passionate about GI content, this is the podcast for you.
Hello, everyone. Good morning. Welcome to another episode of the UEG Podcast. It's Pradeep Mundra here. I'm a gastroenterologist from the UK and podcast host for the UEG. The weather's changing these days. A brilliant spring coming up for most of us, I'm assuming. So today we move on to a bit about IBD and IBD management, which has become more and more complicated with a plethora of new drugs and different targets of treatment. Most of us and patients alike have increasing access to these new drugs. So lately, the use of these drugs in complex patient situations is increasing, and we come across this on a day-to-day basis. A couple of these special situations that I can think of is those patients who have had previous cancers and now in remission, and those patients who have active malignancy and they need active management of their IBD, whether these are aggressive type cancers or slow-growing cancers. These are all few different case scenarios that are not easy to deal with and sometimes need decision-making, probably in an MDT setting. But sometimes we are left on our own to make decisions along with our patients. And it may be a bit confusing for both clinicians, the decision-makers, and patients. Sometimes you put forward some statements to the patients, and then it's a bit difficult for both of us to make that decision. And today's discussion with our guest is on this scenario. We'll be discussing about cancer risks in IBD, or whether that's disease-related itself, or how IBD therapies influence malignancy risk, whether they increase or decrease. We can talk about that. And we also discuss about safe use of IBD treatment in patients with past and present history of malignancy. For the purpose of this particular episode, we will not delve into IBD-related colorectal cancer. The reason being that that's a huge topic altogether, and I would purposefully leave that aspect out of the discussion today, and we will probably have its own podcast for that. Today's guest is Dr. Hannah Gordon, who is a consultant gastroenterologist at University Hospitals, Oxford, in the UK. Hanna was the project coordinator and lead author for the ECHO guidelines on IBD and malignancy, which was published a couple of years ago. Hanna's also co-authored and is part of the guideline committee for various other guidelines, including the ECHO therapeutics in Crohn's guidelines and the latest BSG IBD guidelines. Welcome to the podcast, Hanna.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Pradeep. It's sunny in Oxford here as well. It's a beautiful change for the weather, and welcome back from Morocco.
Thank you.
I totally agree with you that this is an area that we see more and more of in terms of in our clinic. We see patients who are living with or have survived previous cancer. At the moment, I think about one in three of our IBD patients in the clinic is over 60. And of course, with an aging population, this is only going to grow. So I guess we almost have to stop seeing when IBD and cancer collide as a special situation, and unfortunately sort of see it as part of life, because it is something that we are very commonly managing.
Yes, I think in the past, Hannah, we used to get nervous about such patients and then put them through the MDT and things. But I guess with more and more knowledge that we have and guidelines like yours would really help us manage these situations. Because IBD MDTs will be overburdened with lots of these complex patients.
You're totally right. I'm not suggesting that we don't discuss in the MDT, just more that it's becoming more and more common. But you're really right. I think the first ECHO malignancy guideline in 2015, really at that point, was suggesting that patients who'd had cancer before should not be on most immunosuppressive therapies, or then it was biologics, now advanced therapies, for between 2 to 5 years after resolution of their cancer. And I think this brings concerns is that since that era, we know that treating IBD effectively is really important, and recurrent courses of steroids, recurrent disease flares isn't good for the patients either.
Okay. Hannah, let's start with the first point of discussion. I just wanted to start with the risk of malignancy in patients with IBD. I mean, you know, without the drugs, not unrelated to the drugs, does IBD increase the risk of malignancy overall in patients?
I think so. I mean, you've asked me to stay largely away from the more well-known areas such as colorectal cancer, which is an established risk with established screening pathways, even multivariate risk calculators. PSC is another more obvious, well-known area where there is a high enough malignancy risk that we've established ways in which we mitigate that, both the colorectal cancer and the cholangiocarcinoma. I think one of the more pressing areas or the more difficult areas is when there is an increased risk, but the absolute risk is still relatively rare, and how we mitigate that and how we manage our patients appropriately. I mean, an example I could give with that is the risk of, for example, small bowel cancers in patients with small bowel Crohn's disease. There is definitely an appreciable relative risk compared with the rest of the population, but the absolute risk is still quite low. I think when we were doing the malignancy guidelines, the systematic review we undertook showed papers that were quoting risks within the remit of sort of 25 patients per 100,000 patient years. And these are numbers that I think even as doctors, it's quite hard for us to get our head around. So whereas communicating that risk to patients and when it's appropriate to communicate, because you want the balance, you want a really informed, empowered patient actively involved in their own decisions, but you also don't want a terrified patient who every time they come to clinic is being told about the risk of another cancer, another cancer, another cancer, when the absolute risk is much lower than other cancers that we don't have population screening for the general population. So I think it can be a really tricky balance. Another area that I think puts fear into us is risk of perianal fistula cancers, risk of rectal stump cancers in patients who have elected not to undergo proctectomy or pouch formation. And yes, these are areas that we worry about, but sometimes surveillance is difficult. In the context of the rectal stump surveillance, the practicalities of surveying an area of bowel with diversion colitis is challenging in itself. But also the intensity of, for example, coming back to the small bowel cancer case, which I know when we were prepping for this, you were quite interested in talking through sort of the logistics and the reality of whether and when we undertake routine MREs in well patients with small bowel Crohn's disease when the absolute risk is pretty low.
Okay. So I guess the language that we use, I think we are all different as clinicians. Some of us like to quote the risk. Some of them like to use sort of loose terms such as, oh, there's a high risk, there's a low risk, and there's negligible overall. I think the language that we use with our patients is important in this. Like whatever risk that you mentioned there, I mean, and I'm in my own mind, I'm very confused. You know, is that high, low? What is it? I think what you said there is the kind of language that we use with other patients is important. So my conclusion or based on that is that there is a slightly increased risk of cancers, solid organ malignancies and other malignancies in patients with IBD, irrespective of the drugs or irrespective of therapy they're on. However, this risk is very low. Is that what you're getting at?
I think for the most cancers, that's true. And I also think when we convey things to our patients, it's important that we're doing it with purpose. I mean, when we talk about, for example, the colorectal cancer, we're letting them know, and we're letting them know of a surveillance program and symptoms to watch out for. And I think we need to take that in mind when we decide we communicate with any other forms of cancer. I mean, I think especially in terms of the small bowel stricturing patient, when there isn't necessarily an established surveillance pathway, a lot of onus is on the clinician. I mean, we're asking patients to report symptoms to us, to get in touch by the IBD advice services, which aren't necessarily at a first pass so different from symptoms that you would necessarily see with active small bowel or stricturing small bowel Crohn's disease. I wonder if as clinicians, for us, it's something that we just need to consider in the back of our mind if something doesn't look quite right, to involve the GI radiologist, to involve the MDT, and to make sure that we keep it in our mind of a differential when we're planning timing of investigations and how we follow up with tests with our patients.
Yeah, I guess I think it's important for us clinicians and patients alike to have that knowledge. Let's say if I develop a new symptom or whatever, then at least patients or clinicians take appropriate action, investigate them promptly. Having that knowledge helps. I think that's important.
Yeah.
Excellent. Now, moving on to IBD drugs, and I guess we can go through different classes here, Hannah. In the past, I think, you know, most IBD drugs were labeled as being bad in terms of malignancy risk and things. Maybe we should go through that. Maybe we may want to go through it class by class in terms of what IBD drugs are implicated, or maybe even I call it associated with increased risk of malignancy. I want to choose my words carefully here because its causality is different from link or association. So if you kind of maybe go through class by class to kind of explain to us, yeah.
So I think what you're saying is absolutely right. There's an association with some drugs. It's not always in all cases proving a causal relationship, and that needs to be interpreted accordingly, especially when we know that active IBD is itself a risk, certainly for colorectal cancer, or certainly active colonic IBD is a risk for colorectal cancer, and kind of interpreting the relative risks and benefits. But what I think is interesting now, as we have more choice and more options, is whereas before a risk for thiopurines, for example, and I'll come on to talk about a little bit more about this, was historically thought of as a relatively low risk compared with the benefits of the drug. Now that we have different drugs available, it's a little bit of a more nuanced discussion or thought point. Also, now that we're keeping patients on maintenance therapy, be that advanced therapies or otherwise, for more longer periods of time, kind of cumulative risk comes into our decision factor. Kind of going through drugs class by class, starting with the earlier drugs and the basics, I don't think that I know of any cancer-associated risks with steroids, with exclusive enteral nutrition, or with mesalazine. Coming through, and I'm going through kind of the timeline of when these drugs became widely available to us. I'm not picking them for any other reasons. Now, the thiopurines is an interesting one because there is a recognized increased relative risk of cancers. The two big groups that I think are relatively certain there is an association, one being hematological malignancy, the other being non-melanomatous skin cancer, in particular squamous cell carcinoma of the skin. So thinking mainly of the hematological risk, because I think this is one that we fear and we worry about. I'm going to say first and foremost, I'm aware that the absolute risk is low. The relative risk seems to be highest when used in combination with an anti-TNF and in young men, especially those who have not been exposed previously to EBV. The absolute risk is higher in older people because the absolute risk of all cancers is higher in older people. And I believe if you're using a thiopurine as monotherapy, by the time you get sort of between 60 to 70, and these are ballpark figures, about 1 in 200 patients per year may develop a thiopurine-related cancer. And these stats do differ depending on the different cohorts. For me, what I take home from that when using thiopurines, and again, there is no textbook or clear consensus on how we all interpret risk, is that for me, for a young patient, especially if they've not been exposed to Epstein-Barr virus, I think, is this the right choice of drug for them? Is there another option? In Crohn's disease, I tend not to use the thiopurines as a monotherapy because I don't think they work very well. But if I'm using them as combination therapy, as in with an anti-TNF therapy, after a year, I think, do they need to be on both? And in the majority of patients, I think about stepping it down so you don't have that cumulative risk. When it comes to our practice where I work is generally we're using less and less thiopurines across both disease types, across Crohn's disease and across ulcerative colitis. I think within ulcerative colitis, there's more evidence of them being an efficacious drug. And again, the conversations on risk are quite nuanced because the absolute risks are low, but there is a relative risk probably compared with other drugs that you could use as an alternative. So for me personally, I don't tend to use them, but I do think particular areas where we all should be starting to worry a bit more about thiopurine risk is in the older patient cohort, sort of the over 60s, or people that have got a cumulative exposure to them above 7 or 8 years, which is when we start seeing more of the risk. Do they definitely need to be on the drug? And is there a safer alternative? And that is there a safer alternative question may depend locally on finances, ability to provide drugs that are maybe less cost effective for other thiopurines, and the patient journey of the individual patient. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think I've got the overall gist. So overall, we agree that there is ever so slightly increased risk of malignancy in patients exposed to thiopurine, which is mainly lymphoproliferative disorders. And you mentioned EBV. Can I just clarify on that? Just for the sake of the registrars, can you clarify? So EBV status, you check by checking their IgG, and if they are positive.
So if they're positive, they've been exposed to it before. So I'm not too worried about this in context of a thiopurine. If someone has never had mono glandular fever, EBV, and they develop it whilst on a thiopurine, there's a reasonable risk of developing a significant post-mononucleus hematological malignancy. So things like the hepatosplenic T-cell lymphomas, which if it's an avoidable, if it's an avoidable consequence, it's pretty tragic when it happens. So that's why my practice would be to be screening for EBV, and also judicious use of the thiopurines.
Yeah, and it's such a simple test, right? Because you're sending them for other serology anyway, so you just add on an EBV to that and be more, I guess, more cautious and think of alternatives if they are EBV naive or serology negative or IgG negative. Okay, that's clear. And you mentioned that a combination therapy with anti-TNFs increases the risk.
Yeah, I think it just briefly on that one. I think anti-TNF itself as a risk for malignancy, there's small signals that it may be a risk for melanoma, especially in Crohn's disease, but less so in ulcerative colitis. There's a small signal that the anti-TNF itself may be a risk for hematological malignancy, although it's not always replicated in all cohorts. But when the two are combined together, the risk becomes more significant. And I think that kind of makes sense. If we're thinking that a lot of the hematological malignancies may in some way be virally driven, it would make sense that a combination immunosuppression may impact that. But just in terms of for any patients or anyone listening, again, I will stress that the absolute risk is low and needs to be balanced with the risks associated with poor disease control.
Yes, I think that's probably there's huge risk of undertreating the disease in most scenarios. That's a common theme that I see. Moving on to new drugs, any of the new drugs implicated?
So this is a reasonably easy one to answer, I think, in the sense that the meta-analysis data and the post-marketing data from vedolizumab suggests that it's safe and no overall increased risk of any malignancy. I think earlier on in the use of vedolizumab, we were maybe worried that we might see more colorectal dysplasia and colorectal cancers because in theory, you might be reducing immune surveillance of the gut, because not only are we preventing the proactive inflammatory T cells from coming into the gut, but that mechanism is quite conserved amongst other cell types as well. But fortunately, we've now been using vedolizumab, I believe, from just over 10 years, and none of the data that I'm aware of has shown any adverse signals in that area. So in general, I think this can be thought of as a relatively safe option. I'm not aware of any data for ustekinumab being associated with any malignancy, either in the IBD population or in the psoriasis registries from dermatology. And similarly, there's less data available for the P19s, that's the guselkumab, mirikizumab, risankizumab, because these are newer drugs. But from what I do know of them, they seem to be safe.
Okay, but these are very early, because I've only known risankizumab for 1 year, I think, in my hospital.
I think for IBD, but we've had it for a couple of years. There's obviously the trial coming through, but it's been used for other conditions across other immune-mediated disorders with no adverse safety signals to date. Admittedly, I think when other specialties use similar drugs, sometimes the drug dosing and obviously the patient population is not identical. But so far, so good. The signals are seeming reassuring. The JAK inhibitors is an interesting one because across the IBD population, I don't know of any associations between JAK inhibitors and malignancy. And I believe when there was a meta-analysis data across all of the immune-mediated disorders, use of JAK inhibitors compared with placebo, they're looking at all of the different trials, there wasn't a significant safety signal. The follow-up period of all of the trials that went into that and whether it's appropriate for detection of malignancy, I don't know. But in general, across the IBD cohort, there doesn't seem to be too much risk associated with JAK inhibitor use. However, tofacitinib, one of the three JAK inhibitors that's licensed for IBD, did in the rheumatology population, in particular in older patients with rheumatoid arthritis, show some quite, I'll say, reasonably worrying safety signals when it came to malignancy. To go into that a bit further, after real-world data showed an association between tofacitinib use and all cancer development, a randomized controlled trial of thousands of patients, I think between 3,000 and 4,000, with safety endpoints was conducted. And across the follow-up, which I believe was about 4 years, in patients with rheumatoid arthritis above 50 years, I think 55 years of age, patients who were managed with tofacitinib had a hazards ratio of about 1.5, so an increased risk of developing cancer compared with those who were managed with an anti-TNF instead. So in a different population, there has been a safety signal. The EMA and the FDA have somewhat taken out of our hands how to interpret this, in that they've essentially said that these drugs should be limited to when there's no other choices in patients with high risk. So coming back to our patients who've had a previous malignancy, older patients, these drugs are not suggested unless there's no other option. However, I still think, especially when we're considering the elderly, needs to be balanced against the fact that everything is more risky in this population, including steroids and including colectomy. So really, there has to be some quite careful risk balancing. But for me, if I was thinking of using a JAK inhibitor in a patient with a previous cancer, or maybe even some of the older patients, it's something that I would discuss in an MDT setting and make sure that discussions were underway with the oncologist as well. So it wasn't just one clinician taking on that risk with one patient. It was properly discussed and all alternatives considered.
Okay. So the take home from that discussion, Hannah, in terms of IBD drugs and risk of malignancy, thiopurines increase risk. Combination treatment of thiopurines and anti-TNFs increase. Anti-TNFs mixed signals, you said, or...
Probably some slight increased association with hematological malignancy and melanoma.
Yeah, okay. And every other drug, there's no link other than JAK inhibitors.
Well, yeah, JAK inhibitor in other populations, there is a signal associating them with increased cancer risk.
Yeah. So that's much more reassuring than my knowledge 10 years ago when I read the last set of guidelines. So that's interesting. Okay. Hannah, just want to sort of go through the practical aspects of counseling a patient. You know, we recently in our team came across an individual who has active IBD, active ulcerative colitis. He has active symptoms and calprotectin is high. He has active disease. But he's so reluctant to start the medication because of the very risk of malignancy. You know, you present all the data to him, you mention everything, but this individual remains unconvinced. How do you approach such patients in your practice?
So I think this is a really interesting point. I think that firstly, our job is not to push patients to do things that they don't want to do. It's to make sure they have the right information to make an informed decision that, like themselves. So you've mentioned about talking about the risk of malignancy associated with different treatments, and you've already counseled them and you've already explained that you can offer them many drugs where, to our knowledge, there is no increased risk of malignancy. So I think that's really important. I think asking the patient where they've got their information from, why they are so worried, I think is really important, because sometimes it can come from social media or from areas that are not necessarily peer-reviewed, for example. Actually, sometimes I've had quite good effect by explaining to the patients why I think it's safe, maybe in the clinic letter signposting a couple of resources if they want to go and read the information themselves. The other side to counselling patients, if they're not keen to accept a treatment, is to make sure that they're very aware of the risks of not treating. And actually, when it comes to, you've described a patient with colonic IBD, ulcerative colitis, this is an area where we're quite enriched with data that shows that active disease is in itself quite a significant malignancy risk. And there are even multivariate risk calculators available, risks of dysplasia. So by, I think, explaining to them, you can even show the patient with some of the risk calculators how significantly elevated their risk of malignancy is by undertreating their disease. The further rung that I will add to that. I mean, it sounds like you're describing a patient who has really tried not very many therapies.
Zero therapies, yeah.
In a patient who's tried a few therapies and they're not working, and the patient is raising the point that, yes, they might be coming at it, I don't like the risks of my drugs. I mean, you can explore whether they're definitely taking the drugs, but presuming they are, like, colectomy is not a dirty word. Like, there are, like, people who have really positive health outcomes without a colon when we've measured quality of life scores after surgical management. So in the context of a patient really not wanting to explore medical therapy, surgical therapy is an option for them. But again, this has to be carefully counseled and careful discussion of risks and benefits of all avenues.
Excellent. That's well summarized, Hannah. Just let's move on to this, more probably the most common clinical scenario that we deal with. Patients who have had past history of malignancy, or patients during the journey of their IBD treatment develop a new malignancy. I don't know how you want to deal with whether we can go class by class.
So I think you're asking me about evidence where, like, a situation, I've just told you to use the evidence, and now you're asking about situation where, one, there is minimal evidence, and two, there is next to no evidence. So let's go with minimal evidence first. So I'm being slightly flippant in the sense I help write a guideline on this. I do obviously think there are strengths to real-world data and to follow-up, but I'll talk through the challenges that we have. So in a patient, for example, who, like, has had a breast cancer, is living long-term on a hormone therapy, it's difficult to actually even be completely sure in your mind whether that's living with a cancer or whether that's a fully treated cancer, but it's not an active issue at the moment. They're on their anastrozole and they have a flare of known inflammatory bowel disease, and thinking about how we approach that patient. So firstly, it's just as important to treat that patient's IBD as it is to treat any other patient's IBD. So we shouldn't forget that. And actually, I think it was Jordan Axelrod, did a review of real-world data and actually found that the anti-androgen and anti-estrogen, or the hormonal-based therapies, are indeed a risk factor for flare for patients with known IBD who are managed for a breast or prostate cancer. So in themselves, these patients can be quite high risk of disease flare. So essentially, when it comes to malignancy in IBD, there are retrospective data sets in patients who've used our therapies after a previous cancer. And to sum that up sort of in a nutshell, none of them, to my knowledge, seem dangerous for when you're looking at all cancers as a whole. The challenge in interpreting these data is that if you're looking at a couple of hundred patients, or in some case series, 20 patients, it's great to know that in those 20 patients, everything has seemed to be safe. This is thinking about the newer drugs, things like vedolizumab, ustekinumab. And if you summarize them to a couple of hundred patients in a meta-analysis or a systematic review, brilliant that there's no adverse safety signals. But this probably isn't powered for really, really long-term follow-up. So I think it's really reassuring that there hasn't been any signals that medications are dangerous. But if you want to look at the subtleties of specific cancer types and specific IBD phenotypes and specific drug, that's quite a difficult thing to have really long-term robust data on. But that doesn't mean that we do nothing, because obviously do no harm doesn't mean do nothing and don't use the drug. It's just quite difficult to summarize what the exact safety profile is. But so far, most of our IBD therapies appear to be safe. We've actually got more data, sort of, I think for the anti-TNF, like 17,000 patient years worth of surmised very small retrospective studies on patients with previous cancer. There's a Danish population study looking at about 400 or 500 patients with immune-mediated disorders who used anti-TNF after a known IBD diagnosis. And there haven't been any adverse signals when it comes to new cancer or recurrence of the previous cancer. And so really positive take-home messages in all of our therapies, including the anti-TNFs. There are probably a couple of scenarios where I would think twice about using the anti-TNFs in people with a previous or a recent cancer. One of them, I think, would be a hematological cancer, not least of all that the logistics, if someone was about to be blasted with a lot of chemotherapy, another drug that works as an immunosuppressive therapy, is maybe not the right drug for that patient. And also because of the association with anti-TNF and thiopurines with hematological malignancy, I think maybe it's not the top choice. Melanoma, would be another one where I'd be slightly nervous in using an anti-TNF. It was a patient with a relatively recent melanoma diagnosis. This is partly because of Millie Long's registry data that showed a slightly increased risk of melanoma per se with anti-TNF, albeit a relatively small one. It's partly also that in the world of immune checkpoint inhibitor colitis, there is some very small number data to suggest that maybe patients who receive anti-TNF or infliximab rather than vedolizumab as their salvage therapy may have a slight increased risk of disease progression. Now, this is a small point that's not replicated in all cohorts. So I'm certainly not saying never use it, don't use it in severe immune checkpoint inhibitor colitis, not at all. I'm just saying that in a more stable IBD patient with a melanoma or a history of a recent melanoma, when there are other options available, I would go for the other options first. When it comes to some of the newer drugs, the JAK inhibitor drugs, like the P19 inhibitors, the actual number of data is limited. So far, I don't know that anything to suggest they're dangerous, but I think there are even small numbers in patients with prior cancers than with any of the other drugs. And EMA and FDA have this warning issued with regards to JAK inhibitor use in high-risk patients. So JAK inhibitor in someone with a prior or certainly an active malignancy would involve an MDT discussion, would involve discussion with the oncologist. But that said, I can think of at least one patient I know of who's doing well on a JAK inhibitor with a previous prostate cancer. And this involved very careful counselling with the patient and very careful discussion. But not an absolute no.
Yeah. So what I take home from that, Hannah, is there's no one rule fits all. Talking about patients who have had previous history of malignancy, now treated, well, let's call them, they are in remission. There's always that risk that they might have recurrence of this cancer. So previously treated malignancies, most drugs don't have any issues. They can be used, although you take a piece of caution in this scenario and avoid drugs which have been implicated or associated with malignancies, such as, thiopurines, anti-TNFs in case of hematological malignancies. You kind of approach that cautiously, especially when there are other alternatives available. So you reach out for the other alternatives first.
Yeah. And I also do think that, I mean, IBD care is always a team sport, but like when it comes to malignancy care, you're talking earlier about the use of the MDT. I mean, yes, the MDTs were getting busier and busier, but they're still a very important part of care. And inviting our oncologists along to MDTs can be really useful when we're discussing these patients, especially if the more complex cases.
Okay, but let's say if your patient is put in a position where they've had previous history of malignancy, now in remission, and the only drug that works for them or gives them amazing quality of life is an anti-TNF or a thiopurine, you'll be perfectly happy to use these drugs.
Well, I think, again, it involves case-by-case discussion, but I think there's not good evidence that in cancers as a whole, and admittedly talking about cancers as a whole as one disease type definitely has limitations to it, but we don't have data to support that we shouldn't be using anti-TNFs as a whole in patients with malignancy. When it comes to thiopurine in people with previous cancer, the data was actually reasonably reassuring, which is it's not surprising, but in the most recent systematic review has tens of thousands of patient year follow-up, and yet it didn't actually show the known signals that we know from the other patient population about the risk associated with thiopurines and malignancy. So I think we can take from that the absolute risk is low. I've talked before about using thiopurines judiciously. Whether they need to be on both forevermore is a discussion that we need to have case by case with our patients. But I don't think we need to be terrified about use of these drugs in patients because they've previously had a cancer.
Excellent. That's well summarized, Hannah. And I just now want to move on to patients who have active malignancy ongoing, whether that's aggressive type cancers or slow-growing cancers, such as prostate cancer, for example. What's your approach to medications, IBD therapy? Yeah.
Really good question. So I think it depends on what the therapy is and what the disease type is, both with the IBD and with the cancer type. So, for example, if you've got someone who's with a new diagnosis of, for example, a breast cancer, who was very stable on vedolizumab for ulcerative colitis, that wouldn't be a scenario where I would want to stop the treatment because the patient is stable. They're well from if someone's unwell with one, has got the shock of a new breast cancer diagnosis, the last thing they want is their colitis to flare. So I would keep them on the treatment. And again, it depends on also what the oncologist then wants to do, because if you flip that scenario and your patient was on both a thiopurine and an anti-TNF, and the oncologist wanted to give an aggressive chemotherapy regime, then the current medication that they're on might not be the right one for them. And that would be a discussion to be made in a MDT setting. If you were then going to step down IBD therapy, for example, if someone is starting some aggressive R-TROP regime, they're already getting steroids, they're already getting lots of chemotherapy. The anti-TNF does not mean to need to be thrown in the mix in the neutropenic patient. Then the conversation is, do we just stop the anti-TNF, watch, wait, and monitor, or do we start something else instead? And I think, again, that depends on patient by patient and what the cancer treatment is. Coming to the UC scenario, if you've had a patient who's recently had acute severe colitis, has been really unwell, that's something that is not only horrible for the patient, but if that happens again, it's going to put a block in their cancer treatment. If they're that unwell that they need to be admitted, they need emergency management for IBD, it's not only bad for them in terms of quality of life, their IBD care, but it might actually cause a pause in their cancer care. So keeping the disease in remission is really important. And in that case, you might think about, if you're going to step down an anti-TNF because they're about to have aggressive chemotherapy, will we watch and wait, or will we think about whether they go on, for example, vedolizumab? And again, this is not evidence-based answers I'm giving you. It's something that would be discussed in an MDT setting. If the patient has had a tiny bit of proctitis and could potentially manage with topical therapy, that might be the most appropriate treatment for that particular patient. So I think you wanted clarity from me, and I'm giving you more and more questions. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine, because it doesn't seem to be as simple as I thought it would be. But it looks like if patient needs the medication, if they are absolutely dependent on it, all I wanted to know is it's not an absolute contraindication to use these drugs. That's the main thing I guess everyone wants to know is, I cannot use anti-TNF for these patients who have active malignancy.
No, I think it's not. There aren't really many absolutes. The caveat to that is, for example, if the patient had a melanoma and there's even some evidence that the anti-TNF may be driving the melanoma, I'd want to change them to something else. But I also think increasingly now, the discussion is about, I mean, we're mitigating a lot of risk amongst a lot of uncertainty. These are not going to be completely neat evidence-based answers, but we do also need to at all times consider the risk of active disease and the risk of disease flare.
Okay, that's good. Good to know. Thanks. Maybe the next one is a bit simple. Just in patients with active malignancy, is there any contraindications to use steroids at all?
No, not that I know of. I mean, if someone is flaring and needs steroids, I think that they need their steroids. But the caveat to that I will say is that steroids are not always the best way to treat IBD, as you know. So yes, there are definite situations where people will need steroids, colonic disease that's having a nasty flare, and we need to get that managed. But now we're certainly not using steroids for maintenance. If people are not responding to steroids or having need for recurrent courses, as you would with any other patient, we need to think about, if we're reaching for the steroids, do we need to be reaching for something else as well?
Yeah. Hannah, moving on, I think you briefly mentioned this before. In terms of cancer treatment, let's say chemotherapy, other types of treatment, let's leave out the immunotherapy because that's a separate discussion altogether. Now, chemo, radiotherapy, or hormone treatment, does any of the treatment for cancer affect the IBD natural history at all? I think you briefly mentioned about hormone treatment previously.
So that's a really good question. But I'm going to also preface this by saying, just because something may affect the IBD history doesn't mean that we shouldn't use it. And I think that's also an important point for all drugs. I'm not going to go into the details of checkpoint inhibitors, but I would include that in this discussion somewhat. So in terms of I mentioned looking at patients who've been in remission from their IBD at the beginning of their disease journey, the hormone-based therapies, the anti-estrogen and anti-androgen type therapies, are associated with an increased risk of disease flare. So when it comes to chemotherapy, I don't know. I don't think there's a known association, although it's not, people with chemotherapy often get gastrointestinal symptoms, but I don't think they're associated per se with IBD flare. When it comes to radiotherapy, this is really difficult, but I'm going to stress this does not mean that patients with prostate cancer who've got ulcerative colitis should not have radiotherapy. This should be a treatment option available to these patients. But whether someone who gets radiation proctitis is having a UC flare or is having radiation proctitis is sometimes quite difficult to distinguish. And actually looking at the data for this, different studies suggest different things when it comes to radiotherapy and UC flare. But some of the studies suggest that there's no increased risk in hospitalization and there's no increased risk in surgery. So it's not saying that anyone with prostate cancer who has radiotherapy has a risk of lower GI symptoms and radiation proctitis. And of course, our patients are no less at risk than anything else, but I don't think it's completely clear cut to suggest that it's going to cause a disease flare per se. It probably is another reason to make sure that the proctitis or the left side or the colitis is as well controlled as it can be when embarking on treatments, but I don't think it necessarily causes a flare as such.
Okay. Anna, thanks for all the discussion. So far, we have covered a few topics. We covered whether IBD is associated with malignancy. Then we covered drugs, which increase the risk of malignancy in IBD. We covered how to use drugs if patients had previous history of malignancy and those who have active malignancy. And I would ask listeners, if they come across any scenarios, to refer to the ECHO guidelines. They're well written, I think, really succinct and very clear. Thanks for that.
Thank you. There's also another malignancy one under development at the moment. My one will be coming obsolete within about the next 18 months, but definitely keep an eye out to see what the update shows as well.
Okay. And this is from ECHO or this is from BSG?
Yeah. There's a working group in progress. I'm not involved in the second iteration of it, although I know the people that are doing it and I'm sure it's going to be an excellent and very useful resource.
Cool.
It will be interesting to see what areas are being focused on to renew the literature review and to update. But yeah, we're work in progress. We'll see.
Okay. Anything that we've not covered, Hannah, or any other sort of final thoughts or advice?
No, I think that's good. Yeah.
Okay, that's good. Thanks for your time today and have a lovely day.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to UEG Podcast. We hope you've found some new ideas, insights, and inspiration to take with you. Don't forget to subscribe. And if you like our content, please leave us a review and share our podcast with your colleagues.